It's time for our regular segment with Michael Mulligan from Mulligan Defense Lawyers. It's Legally Speaking on CFAX 1070. Morning, Michael. How are we doing?
Hey, good morning. I'm doing great. Always good to be here.
Some interesting stories on the agenda this week. Where shall we start?
Well, why don't we start in Vernon, if for no other reason than to realize that not all problems that we might have in Victoria are isolated to Victoria.
Indeed.
So this is a interesting case. It's a man who was in his 60s with no previous criminal record, who was charged with both dangerous driving and assault with a weapon. The interesting elements include the alleged weapon and assault, or the alleged weapon was a skid steer, like a digger device. Mm-hmm. And the alleged driving of it and assault were in relation to an effort to remove two people from his property. And a few elements of this could ring true in Victoria as well. First of all, the background involves two people who are described as homeless and claim to have been taking one last bicycle ride on a bicycle trail in Vernon before planning to apparently that day go and leave the drug subculture to deal with their substance use disorder, who decided to stop and take a rest on this man's property. Apparently that had been an issue with other individuals stopping. Sounds like the bike lane went by his property and there had been issues in the past, although no indication that these two people had previously been on the man's property. The man gets home, the skid steer owner, and decides to go over and ask these people to leave his lawn. They don't move from where they are. Apparently they thought they had a right to be there. The man then tried calling bylaw. They told him to phone the police. He didn't phone the police. Instead, what he did was turn on his lawn sprinkler, trying to get the people to move by doing that. They got wet, but they didn't leave. The man then decided to turn it up a notch by going and getting in his skid steer Bobcat, which he used for his landscaping business. Uh-oh. This is where things start to go sideways. The property owner decides to go over and use the skid steer to push the property of the two people. Apparently they had like all of their worldly belongings with them. Push their property off of his yard in order to try to get the people to move. That didn't produce a positive outcome, probably combined with the sprinkler effort, and now this, and things escalated further with the male individual deciding to try to stop the bobcat using a chain, and then also apparently picking up a handsaw and damaging a flower bed, I guess, out of anger for the effort to remove them or remove the belongings with the skid steer.
Hmm.
The man then pushed the belongings more than just off his property, which was something the judge focused on, pushing them further down the bicycle path to in front of his neighbor's house. I'm sure not appreciated by the neighbor, and certainly not by the two people involved.
Yeah.
And in that entire process, the female person who was on the property, it was unclear whether she was hit by the skid steer in the shin. There is some dispute about that. But it the evidence appeared to be that the driver of the skid steer was sort of driving the skid steer towards these people, trying to get them to get off his yard. May or may not have contacted with them. That's made contact with the shin of the woman. And so the judge had to sort out, is this dangerous driving? And is this an assault with a weapon? And the part of that legal analysis starts with, well, what is a weapon? And usually it's not going to be a skid steer, but the definition of weapon in the criminal code for the purpose of the assault provision is pretty broad. And it says that a weapon means anything used, designed to be used, or intended for use in causing death or injury to any person or for the purpose of threatening or intimidating any person. That's the definition.
Interesting.
And so given that broad definition, even though you're not usually going to have a skid steer device as a weapon, the judge found that it did constitute a weapon here. And then the other challenge for the bobcat driver, property owner, is that the definition of what can constitute an assault is fairly broad. And first of all, the judge seemed to accept that this woman's shin was contacted by the skid steer. But you can also commit an assault by if you're engaged in the threatened application of force to someone else.
Hmm.
And the judge found as well that that was made out on the basis of how the bobcat was being driven. All of that then brought the judge to the analysis of dangerous driving. And again, you don't usually see a lot of dangerous driving cases involving landscaping equipment. But the legal analysis would be the same as if you were dealing with a car. And this was an issue for the Supreme Court of Canada a number of years ago in terms of what's required for the criminal code offense of dangerous driving. And the Supreme Court of Canada had to wrestle with the issue of, does that require somebody to intentionally drive in a dangerous way? Because, you know, the issue is what most criminal offenses involve an element of mens rea, right?
Yes.
Like the intent to do something wrong. And the issue was, well, does that mean that somebody has to constitute the criminal offense of dangerous driving as opposed to, for example, driving without due care and attention under the Motor Vehicle Act? Does that mean that the person has to set out saying, okay, I'm about to be dangerous, here I go?
Yeah.
Or is something sort of less than that what is required? And ultimately, the Supreme Court of Canada landed on less than that in the sense that the mens rea required for dangerous driving doesn't involve a necessity to prove the person subjectively intended to drive in a dangerous way. What's required is for the Crown to prove that the driving was a marked departure from the standard of care of a reasonably prudent driver. So it's sort of objective in that way.
Yeah.
And sometimes the way I describe that to people is it's like, you know, what's the difference between driving without due care and attention and dangerous driving?
Yes.
You know, what is a marked departure?
Yeah.
Sometimes I would describe that as, you know, if it's the kind of driving that would cause people to say, oh, my goodness, that person's going to kill someone. Right. And, you know, phone the police out of worry about the driving as opposed to just, hey, you shouldn't have been, you know, changing your CD for so long.
Yeah.
Or, hey, that person's going a bit fast. And so here, the judge didn't have too much difficulty finding that the bobcat was being driven in that kind of a way, a marked departure from the standard of care of a reasonably prudent driver, because it was quite close to these people, might have made contact with the shin of the woman. So on the basis of that, the judge found that not only was assault with a weapon made out, but dangerous driving was made out. One of the implications of that, and it's not dealt with in the decision, is that if you get a criminal code driving conviction like that, you're going to wind up with a driving prohibition imposed under the Motor Vehicle Act. That's going to be a significant consequence for somebody who operates machinery and is a landscaping business. So that's the outcome of it. And I thought it was worth mentioning both for those legal concepts of what's a weapon and what's dangerous driving the conviction. But it's also just an example of, I guess, the level of frustration, not only in Victoria and Vancouver, but other parts of the province, you know, with some of the sort of social disorder that we've all seen, or many of us have seen, that's flowed from drug use. And so that's not limited to larger cities. That's the sort of frustration that's resulted in this very unfortunate incident. Clearly, you know, don't take the skid steer into your own hands.
No.
You know, you can tell reading this thing that what this person just eventually, it was otherwise described as law-abiding and no record. Eventually, it sounds like just went overboard after dealing with, sounds like, multiple occasions when people were trespassing and transient people living on being on his property and these people not responding. I must say, I also smiled with the, clearly this would come from the evidence of the two people that they were allegedly going on one last bike ride to the beach before going to get away from the drug subculture and get treatment for their substance use disorder.
Yes.
You know, I must say, as a criminal lawyer who spent a lot of time sitting in remand court, you with some frequency hear similar stories of good intentions that, you know, that, of course, get interfered with when, you know, just that one last trip. I was just on my way to the treatment center, and it just happens to be that this was the unfortunate time that I usually person gets arrested or something goes haywire, you know, they get picked up on that outstanding warrant or what it might be, whatever it might be. But, you know, here, you know, after some 20 years of being homeless and being addicted to drugs, it sounds like that was their explanation. This was their one last trip by bicycle to the beach before they were planning to go get clean. So that's the story out of Vernon, and if nothing else, it's a cautionary tale and should make you feel like perhaps we're not alone dealing with some of these things. There are obviously issues and frustrations all over British Columbia. So that's the skid steer and the dangerous driving.
All right. Up next on Legally Speaking, challenges to public health orders, firing health workers who are not vaccinated, largely dismissed. What does that mean? We'll talk about it after this. Back on the air here at CFAX 1070, Legally Speaking, as we continue with Michael Mulligan from Mulligan Defense Lawyers. Michael, you and I have discussed a number of times British Columbia's public health orders with respect to vaccination requirements in the workplace, and there was an update in this matter this week.
Indeed there was, and there are a few interesting elements to it. First of all, this was a challenge brought to public health orders made by Dr. Bonnie Henry in October of 2023. So it's sort of interesting because it's dealing with a orders that were made, you know, not that long ago. And this was a challenge heard, the court heard together 15 different challenges combined into this one case. And the case was comprised of a whole collection of people who were healthcare workers in British Columbia. There's a surgeon, several doctors, administrators, therapists, nurses, nurse practitioners, a whole bunch of people, psychiatrists, all of whom had been fired for not getting vaccinated for COVID. And the challenges that were brought included, first of all, a challenge to the reasonableness of the decision to fire all of these people as a result of not being vaccinated in 2023. And so part of the argument there was, hey, this is no longer an emergency. You know, virtually everyone who wished to be vaccinated was vaccinated. Other arguments included, this is unreasonable because other people are permitted into health facilities who are not vaccinated, patients, construction workers, all kinds of other people. And so there was an argument that, hey, this is just not reasonable to fire all of these people. Or not permit them to return to work in 2023, arguing, hey, this isn't some earlier time dealing with COVID. Various other and I should say on that front, the important thing to bear in mind is that when you're doing what's called a judicial review of an administrative decision, in this case, the administrative decision issuing this order in 2023, prohibiting these people from working or firing them, the analysis in court is not an analysis of whether the judge thinks that was the right decision. It's an assessment of whether the decision is reasonable. Like, you know, is this a decision within the realm of reasonable decisions that somebody could have made with the evidence available to them? And on that assessment, the judge concluded that, well, of course, there are all kinds of different factors in 2023, scientific evidence about the you know, state of the state of COVID and the you know, all of these things, found that nonetheless there was enough evidence to conclude that the order, even in 2023, remained a reasonable one, with one interesting exception. One of the categories of people who were fired were people who worked remotely, so on that particular ground, the judge found that the decision to fire them or not permit them to return to work where they work remotely and have no interaction with patients at all, it applied to them too. And the judge found that for that category of health workers, it did not appear to be reasonable.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So has ordered that be reviewed. Why would you fire the person who works at home on the over Skype or something? And so the other challenges that were brought included a challenge that this breached the religious freedom. Some of the people here, there was evidence that I think the nurse practitioner in this claim attended a church which opposed vaccination on the basis that it, quote, interfered with the providence of God, close quote. And the judge found that it did, in fact, breach her freedom of religion because she had religious grounds for not getting vaccinated. But nonetheless, the judge then engaged in a weighing and found that the importance of the public health objectives outweighed the breach of her religious freedom, and it was constitutionally permissible to fire the nurse practitioner. And then the judge found that for people who had objections that were not based on religious grounds, people who had rejections based on personal concerns or convictions, found that those weren't sufficient to rise to the level that they would be protected by Section 2A of the Charter dealing with religious discrimination, religious freedom. And the judge also rejected a Section 7 fundamental justice argument about the fact that the judge found that you don't have any under Section 7. It doesn't protect your right to be to work or to work in any specific profession, nor does it protect people against the stress or hardship of being refused entry into a profession or their ability to work. And so found that the constitutional arguments didn't fly here for the people who had non-religious grounds. And even the religious ground, even though that was infringed on a weighing, concluded that that was permissible. Interestingly, the current state of affairs, it's reflected in the judgment, requires that in order to be employed or continue to be employed, it's necessary for healthcare workers to be vaccinated. But there isn't a requirement, although they recommend it, that the that healthcare workers receive a updated vaccine against the XBB.1.5 vaccine. Although that is a requirement for new people that wish to work in any of the health fields in British Columbia. So if somebody, even now in 2024, even if they were originally vaccinated, they would be unable to get employment in a health field as a result of the order, unless they also received the newest booster version. And so that requirement applies to new people that wish to get jobs as nurses or doctors, but they won't fire people who haven't got the booster. They just recommend it, which is an interesting distinction. And so that's the state of affairs. Virtually all of it was dismissed, with that one exception that it was viewed as unreasonable to fire people that work remotely for not being vaccinated, which it's surprising that that, that wouldn't have been apparent to anyone earlier, that perhaps that is not a reasonable requirement. And so even on that ground, the judge didn't just reverse it. The judge sent it back for reconsideration. And so Dr. Henry will need to revisit or reconsider the government decision to fire those people who work remotely or not permit them to apply for work again. So that's the latest on COVID. The litigation continues, and interestingly, the orders continue even into 2024.
All right. We have 4 minutes left, and I think we still have that one story with the benefits and the CCP or CPP payments.
Indeed, we do. So this was a application brought by a fellow who had been receiving persons with disability benefits. And the essence of those, it's like a higher amount of social assistance that would be provided by the province if somebody has a disability. It's still not a plush amount of money, but more than, I suppose, what's provided if somebody doesn't have a disability. And the issue or the claim here was that this person then became eligible for Canadian Pension Plan disability payments. And the policy, the provincial policy, is to deduct dollar for dollar any other income the person's receiving, in this case, these Canadian Pension Plan disability benefits. And the complaint the recipient had, even though the dollar amount of the two things is the same at the end of the day, was that the CPP benefits are taxable. And so the result for him was that when the province deducted the CPP benefits from his persons with disability benefits, he had to then pay tax, and it resulted in him having less money. And so he brought this claim arguing that It meant that the province was being unjustly enriched by not having to pay him more for his persons with disability benefits. The amount involved was a deduction in his persons with disability benefits of $642 a month. I guess that's how much he was getting from CPP. But the problem with that, even though I suppose there's certainly an argument based on, hey, is this fair, right? Should there be a lower amount if somebody's getting CPP benefits? That doesn't make out a cause of action, right? You can't succeed in a court claim by arguing, hey, that's not fair, or, you know, hey, that legislation shouldn't say that. You need to have some legal cause of action. And so the judge here was dealing with an application by counsel for the province of British Columbia to have this claim dismissed, showing on the basis that it had no prospect of success. It was just doomed to fail. And the judge at the end of the day concluded that indeed that was the case, that even though the man's winding up with less money as a result of this federal payment and the provincial, how the province deals with deducting that, that didn't make out a tort or cause of action against the provincial government. And so the result is that even though the man's getting less money, and even he doesn't have a basis to bring a court case to complain about it, I suppose the small mercy for the man at the end of the day is that the council didn't seek costs against him when the claim was dismissed, because ordinarily, of course, costs would follow the cause. And if you sue and don't succeed, the default position would be you're going to need to pay a portion of the legal expenses of the party that you sued. Yeah. So while the man's going to wind up with less money every month, at least he won't be winding up with an order that he pay the costs of the provincial government in having his claim dismissed.
Yeah, that's actually an important thing to point out as always, Michael. Thank you so much.
Very good. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to be here.
All right. Michael Mulligan with Mulligan Defense Lawyers. Legally speaking, we do it during the second half of our second hour every Thursday.